Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban by J.K. Rowling. Chapter 1. Owl Post. Harry Potter was a highly unusual boy in many ways. For one thing, he hated the summer holidays more than any other time of year. For another, he really wanted to do his homework, but was forced to do it in secret, in the dead of night. And he also happened to be a wizard. It was nearly midnight, and he was lying on his stomach in bed, the blankets drawn right over his head like a tent, a flashlight in one hand, and a large leather-bound book, A History of Magic by Bathilda Bagshot, propped open against the pillow. Harry moved the tip of his eagle feather quill down the page, frowning as he looked for something that would help him write his essay, which burning in the 14th century was completely pointless. Discuss. Harry Potter is spending another lonely summer with the Dursleys when on his birthday night, three owls swoop in. Hedwig, who was Harry's snowy owl, Errol, an elderly great gray owl, and Pigwidgeon, his friend Ron's excitable Scops owl. They brought Harry letters and gifts from his friends. He picked up Ron's letter and unfolded it. Dear Harry, happy birthday. Look, I'm really sorry about that telephone call. I hope the muggles didn't give you a hard time. I asked Dad, and he reckons I shouldn't have shouted. It's amazing here in Egypt. Bill's taken us around all the tombs, and you wouldn't believe the curses those old Egyptian wizards put on them. Mum wouldn't let Ginny come in, the last one. There were all these mutant skeletons in there of muggles who'd broken in and grown extra heads and stuff. I couldn't believe it when Dad won the Daily Prophet draw. 700 galleons. Most of it's gone on this trip, but they're going to buy me a new wand for next year. Harry remembered only too well the occasion when Ron's old wand had snapped. It had happened when the car the two of them had been flying to Hogwarts had crashed into a tree on the school grounds. The letter continued. We'll be back in about a week before the term starts, and we'll be going up to London to get my wand and our new books. Any chance of meeting you there? Don't let the muggles get you down. Try and come to London. Signed, Ron. P.S. Percy's head boy. He got the letter last week. Harry glanced back at the photograph. Percy, who was in his seventh and final year at Hogwarts, was looking particularly smug. He had pinned his head boy badge to the fez perched jauntily on top of his neat hair, his horn-rimmed glasses flashing in the Egyptian sun. Harry now turned to his present and unwrapped it. Inside was what looked like a miniature glass spinning top. There was another note from Ron beneath it. Harry, this is a pocket sneakoscope. If there's someone untrustworthy around, it's supposed to light up and spin. Bill says it's rubbish, sold for wizard tourists and isn't reliable, because it kept lighting up at dinner last night. But he didn't realize Fred and George had put beetles in his soup. Bye, signed Ron. Harry put the pocket sneakoscope on his bedside table, where it stood quite still, balanced on its point, reflecting the luminous hands of his clock. He looked at it happily for a few seconds, then picked up the parcel Hedwig had brought. Inside this, too, was a wrapped present, a card, and a letter, this time from Hermione. Dear Harry, Ron wrote to me and told me about his phone call to your Uncle Vernon. I do hope you're all right. I'm on holiday in France at this moment, and I didn't know how I was going to send this to you. What if they opened it at customs? But then Hedwig turned up. I think she wanted to make sure you got something for your birthday for a change. I bought your present by owl order. There was an advertisement in the Daily Prophet. I've been getting it delivered, so it's so good to keep up with what's going on in the wizarding world. Did you see that picture of Ron and his family a week ago? I bet he's learning loads. I'm really jealous. The ancient Egyptian wizards were fascinating. There's some interesting local history of witchcraft here, too. I've rewritten my whole History of Magic essay to include some of the things I found out. I hope it's not too long. It's two rolls of parchment more than Professor Binns asked for. Ron says he's going to be in London in the last week of the holidays. Can you make it? Will your aunt and uncle let you come? I really hope you can. If not, I'll see you on the Hogwarts Express on September 1st. Love from Hermione. P.S. Ron said, Percy's head boy. I'll bet Percy's really pleased. Ron doesn't seem too happy about it. Harry laughed as he put Hermione's letter aside and picked up her present. It was heavy. Knowing Hermione, he was sure it would be a large book full of very difficult spells, but it wasn't. His heart gave a huge bound as he ripped back the paper and saw a sleek black leather case with silver words stamped across it reading, Broomstick Servicing Kit. Harry feels loved and remembered, and for the first time that summer, he smiles. Extremely unusual, though he was, at that moment, Harry Potter felt just like everyone else. Glad, for the first time in his life, that it was his birthday. Chapter 2. Aunt Marge's Big Mistake. Harry went down to breakfast the next morning to find the three Dursleys already sitting around the kitchen table. They were watching a brand new television, a welcome home for the summer present for Dudley, who had been complaining loudly about the long walk between the fridge and the television in the living room. Dudley had spent most of the summer in the kitchen, his piggy little eyes fixed on the screen and his five chins wobbling as he ate continually. Harry sat down between Dudley and Uncle Vernon, a large, beefy man with very little neck and a lot of mustache. Far from wishing Harry a happy birthday, none of the Dudleys made any sign that they had noticed Harry enter the room. But Harry was far too used to this to care. He helped himself to a piece of toast and then looked up at the reporter on the television who was halfway through a report on an escaped convict.
The public is warned that Black is armed and extremely dangerous. A special hotline has been set up, and any sighting of Black should be reported immediately.
Later, Aunt Marge visits the Dudleys, and she is terribly rude about Harry's parents. Harry tries to stay calm, but when she insults them one time too many, something magical happens. She begins to puff up like a balloon.
More brandy! Yelled Uncle Vernon, who had gone very white.
He emptied the bottle into Aunt Marge's glass.
You boy, he snarled at Harry. Go to bed. Go on.
No, Vernon, Aunt Marge said, holding up a hand, her tiny bloodshot eyes fixed on Harry's. Go on, boy, go on. Proud of your parents, aren't you? They go, they get themselves killed in a car crash. Drunk, I expect.
They didn't die in a car crash, said Harry, who found himself on his feet.
Oh, they died in a car crash, you nasty little liar.
and left you to be a burden on their decent, hard-working relatives," screamed Aunt Marge, swelling with fury. "You are an insolent, ungrateful little..." But Aunt Marge suddenly stopped speaking. For a moment, it looked as though words had failed her. She seemed to be swelling with inexpressible anger. But the swelling didn't stop. Her great red face started to expand. Her tiny eyes bulged and her mouth stretched too tightly for speech. Next second, several buttons had just burst from her tweed jacket and pinged off the walls. She was inflating like a monstrous balloon, her stomach bursting free of her tweed waistband, each of her fingers blowing up like a salami. "Marge!" yelled Uncle Vernon and Aunt Petunia together as Aunt Marge's whole body began to rise off her chair toward the ceiling. She was entirely round. Now, like a vast life buoy with piggy eyes and her hands and feet that stuck out weirdly as she drifted up into the air, making apoplectic popping noises. Ripper came skidding into the room, barking madly, "Whoa, whoa!" "No!" Uncle Vernon seized one of Marge's feet and tried to pull her down again, but was almost lifted from the floor himself. A second later, Ripper leapt forward and sank his teeth into Uncle Vernon's leg. Harry tore from the dining room before anyone could stop him, heading for the cupboard under the stairs. The cupboard door burst magically open as he reached it. In seconds, he had heaved his trunk into the front door. He sprinted upstairs and threw himself under the bed, wrenching up the loose floorboard and grabbed the pillowcase full of his books and birthday presents. He wriggled out, seized Hedwig's empty cage, and dashed back downstairs to his trunk, just as Uncle Vernon burst out of the dining room, his trouser leg in bloody tatters. "Come back here," he bellowed. "Come back and put her right." But a reckless rage had come over Harry. He kicked his trunk open, pulled out his wand, and pointed it at Uncle Vernon. "She deserved it," Harry said, breathing very fast. "She deserved what she got. You keep away from me." He fumbled behind him for the latch on the door. "I'm going," Harry said. "I've had enough." And in the next moment, he was out in the dark, quiet street, heaving his heavy trunk behind him. Heather's cage came under his arm. Harry runs away, frightened, but also relieved to escape. Chapter 3, The Night Bus. Harry was several streets away before he collapsed onto a low wall in Magnolia Crescent, panting from the effort of dragging his trunk. He sat quite still, anger still surging through him, listening to the frantic thumping of his heart. But after 10 minutes alone in the dark street, a new emotion overtook him. Panic. Whichever way he looked at it, he had never been in a worse fix. He was stranded, quite alone in the dark Muggle world, with absolutely nowhere to go. And the worst of it was, he had just done serious magic, which meant that he was almost certainly expelled from Hogwarts. He had broken the decree for the restriction of underage wizardry so badly, he was surprised Ministry of Magic representatives weren't swooping down on him where he sat. On a dark street, Harry sees a huge black dog. Startled, he falls backward, and suddenly a purple triple-decker bus appears. The night bus whisks him away to the wizarding world, where he learns a dangerous prisoner named Sirius Black had escaped. Harry read this article from the front page of the Daily Prophet newspaper. Black still at large. Sirius Black,
possibly the most infamous prisoner ever to be held in Azkaban Fortress, is still eluding capture, the Ministry of Magic confirmed today.
"We are doing all we can to recapture Black," said the Minister of Magic, Cornelius Fudge, this morning. "And we beg the magical community to remain calm."
Fudge had been criticized by some members of the International Federation of Warlocks for informing the Muggle Prime Minister of the crisis.
"Well, really, I had to, don't you know?"
said an irritable Fudge.
"Black is mad. He's a danger to anyone who crosses him, magic or Muggle. I have the Prime Minister's assurance that he will not breathe a word of Black's true identity to anyone. And let's face it, who'd believe him if he did? While Muggles have been told that Black is carrying a gun, a kind of metal wand that Muggles use to kill each other, the magical community lives in fear of a massacre like that of 12 years ago, when Black murdered 13 people with a single curse.
The night bus rolled through the darkness, scattering bushes and wastebaskets, telephone booths and trees, and Harry lay restless and miserable on his feather bed. They were thundering along Charing Cross Road. Harry sat up and watched buildings and benches squeezing themselves out of the night bus's way. The sky was getting a little lighter. He would lie low for a couple of hours, go to Gringotts the moment it opened, and then set off, where he didn't know. Ern slammed on the brakes, and the night bus skidded to a halt in front of a small and shabby-looking pub, the Leaky Cauldron, behind which lay the magical entrance to Diagon Alley.
"Thanks," Harry said to Ern.
He jumped down the steps and helped Stan lower his trunk and Hedwig's cage onto the pavement.
"Well," said Harry, "bye then."
But Stan wasn't paying attention. Still standing in the doorway to the bus, he was goggling at the shadowy entrance to the Leaky Cauldron. Harry found himself being steered inside the pub. A stooping figure bearing a lantern appeared through the door behind the bar. It was Tom, the wizened, toothless landlord. Tom now moved forward, beaming at Harry.
"If you'll follow me, Mr. Potter," he said, "I've already taken your things up."
Harry followed Tom up to a handsome wooden staircase, to a door with a brass number 11 on it, which Tom unlocked and opened for him. Inside was a very comfortable-looking bed, some highly polished oak furniture, a cheerfully crackling fire, and perched on top of the wardrobe,
"Hedwig!" Harry gasped.
The snow owl clicked her beak and fluttered down onto Harry's arm.
"Very smart owl you've got there," chuckled Tom. "Arrived about 5 minutes after you did. If there's anything you need, Mr. Potter, don't hesitate to ask."
He gave another bow and left. Harry sat on his bed for a long time, absent-mindedly stroking Hedwig. The sky outside the window was changing rapidly from deep velvety blue to cold steely gray, and then slowly to pink shot with gold. Harry could hardly believe that he'd left Privet Drive only a few hours ago, that he wasn't expelled, and that he was now facing two completely Dursley-free weeks.
"It's been a very weird night, Hedwig," he yawned.
And, without even removing his glasses, he slumped back into his pillows and fell asleep.
Chapter 4, The Leaky Cauldron. It took Harry several days to get used to this strange new freedom. Never before had he been able to get up whenever he wanted or eat whatever he fancied. He could even go wherever he pleased, as long as it was in Diagon Alley
and as this long cobbled street was packed with the most fascinating wizarding shops in the world, Harry felt no desire to break his word to Fudge and stray back into the Muggle world. Harry ate breakfast each morning in the Leaky Cauldron, where he liked watching the other guests, funny little witches from the country, up for a day's shopping, venerable-looking wizards arguing over the latest article in the Transfiguration Today. Oh, wild-looking warlocks, raucous dwarfs, and once what looked suspiciously like a hag who ordered a plate of raw liver from behind a thick woolen baklava. Harry stays safely at the Leaky Cauldron for the rest of the summer. He meets his friends Ron and Hermione again, and they enjoy the last days of freedom before school. Ron and Harry went to the magical menagerie shop. Ron buckled as something huge and orange came soaring from the top of the highest cage, landed on his head, and then propelled itself, spitting madly at Scabbers. "No, Cruikshanks, no!" cried the witch. But Scabbers shot from between her hands like a bar of soap, landed spray-legged on the floor, and then scampered for the door. "Scabbers!" Ron shouted, racing out of the shop after him. Harry followed. It took them nearly 10 minutes to catch Scabbers, who had taken refuge under a waste paper bin outside. Quality Quidditch supplies. Ron stuffed the trembling rat back into his pocket and straightened up, massaging his head. What was that? It was either a very big cat or quite a small tiger, said Harry. Where's Hermione? Probably getting her owl. They made their way back up the crowded street to the magical menagerie. As they reached it, Hermione came out. But she wasn't carrying an owl. Her arms were clamped tightly around the enormous ginger cat. You bought that monster? Said Ron, his mouth hanging open. He's gorgeous, isn't he? Said Hermione, glowing. Oh, that was a matter of opinion, thought Harry. The cat's ginger fur was thick and fluffy, but it was definitely a bit bow-legged, and its face looked grumpy and oddly squashed, as though it had run headlong into a brick wall. Now that Scabbers was out of sight, however, the cat was purring contentedly in Hermione's arms. Hermione, that thing nearly scalped me, said Ron. He didn't mean to, did you, Cruikshanks? Said Hermione. And what about Scabbers? Said Ron, pointing to the lump in his chest pocket. He needs rest and relaxation. How's he going to get it with that thing around? But grown-ups keep whispering about Sirius Black and how he might be after Harry. So Sirius Black was after him. This explained everything. Fudge had been lenient with him because he was so relieved to find him alive. He'd made Harry promise to stay in Diagon Alley where there were plenty of wizards to keep an eye on him, and he was sending 2 ministry cars to take them all to the station tomorrow so that the Weasleys could look after Harry until he was on the train. Harry lay listening to the muffled shouting next door and wondered why he didn't feel more scared. Sirius Black had murdered 13 people with one curse. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley obviously thought Harry would be panic-stricken if he knew the truth. But Harry happened to agree wholeheartedly with Mrs. Weasley that the safest place on earth was wherever Albus Dumbledore happened to be. Didn't people always say that Dumbledore was the only person Lord Voldemort had ever been afraid of? Surely Black, as Voldemort's right-hand man, would be just as frightened of him. And then there were these Azkaban guards everyone kept talking about. They seemed to scare most people senseless. And if they were stationed all around the school, Black's chances of getting inside seemed very remote. No, all in all, the thing that bothered Harry most was the fact that his chances of visiting Hogsmeade now looked like zero. Nobody would want Harry to leave the safety of the castle until Black was caught. In fact, Harry suspected his every move would be carefully watched until the danger had passed. He scowled at the dark ceiling. Did they think he could look after himself? He'd escaped Lord Voldemort 3 times. He wasn't completely useless. Unbidden, the image of the beast in the shadows of Magnolia Crescent crossed his mind. What to do when you know the worst is coming? "I am not going to be murdered," Harry said out loud. "That's the spirit, dear," said his mirror sleepily. Chapter 5. The Dementor. Tom woke Harry the next morning with his usual toothless grin and a cup of tea. Harry got dressed and was just persuading a disgruntled Hedwig to get back into her cage when Ron banged his way into the room, pulling a sweatshirt over his head and looking irritable. "The sooner we get on the train, the better," he said. "At least I can get away from Percy at Hogwarts. Now he's accusing me of dripping tea on his photo of Penelope Clearwater, you know." Ron grimaced. "His girlfriend. She's hidden her face under the frame because her nose has gone all blotchy." The journey to King's Cross was very uneventful compared with Harry's trip on the night bus. The Ministry of Magic cars seemed almost ordinary, though Harry noticed that they could slide through gaps that Uncle Vernon's new company car certainly couldn't have managed. They reached King's Cross with 20 minutes to spare. The ministry drivers found them trolleys, unloaded their trunks, touched their hats in salute to Mr. Weasley, and drove away, somehow managing to jump to the head of an unmoving line at the traffic lights. Mr. Weasley kept close to Harry's elbow all the way into the station. "Right then," he said, glancing around them. "Let's do this in pairs, as there are so many of us. I'll go through first with Harry." Mr. Weasley strolled toward the barrier between platforms 9 and 10, pushing Harry's trolley and apparently very interested in the inner city 125 that had just arrived at platform 9. With a meaningful look at Harry, he leaned casually against the barrier. Harry imitated him. In a moment, they had fallen sideways through the solid metal onto platform 9 3/4 and looked up to see the Hogwarts Express, a scarlet steam engine puffing smoke over a platform packed with witches and wizards seeing their children onto the train. Percy and Ginny suddenly appeared behind Harry. They were panting and had apparently taken the barrier at a run. Harry, Ron, and Hermione set off down the corridor looking for an empty compartment, but all were full except for the one at the very end of the train. This had only one occupant, a man sitting fast asleep next to the window. Harry, Ron, and Hermione checked on the threshold. The Hogwarts Express was usually reserved for students, and they had never seen an adult there before, except for the witch who pushed the food cart. The stranger was wearing an extremely shabby set of wizard's robes that had been darned in several places. He looked ill and exhausted. Though quite young, his light brown hair was flecked with gray. "Who do you reckon he is?" Ron hissed as they sat down and slid the door shut, taking the seats farthest away from the window. "Professor R.J. Lupin," whispered Hermione at once. "How do you know that?" "It's on his case," she replied, pointing at the luggage rack over the man's head, where there was a small battered case held together with a large quantity of neatly knotted string. The name Professor R.J. Lupin was stamped across one corner in peeling letters. On the train to Hogwarts, the lights suddenly go out, and a tall, hooded creature glides in. It makes Harry feel cold and helpless. Professor Lupin, a kind new teacher, drives the creature away. There was a soft, crackling noise, and a shivering light filled the compartment. Professor Lupin appeared to be holding a handful of flames. They illuminated his tired gray face, but his eyes looked alert and wary. "Stay where you are," he said in the same hoarse voice, and he got slowly to his feet with his handful of fire held out in front of him. But the door slowly slid open before Lupin could reach it. Standing in the doorway, illuminated by the shivering flames in Lupin's hands, was a cloaked figure that towered to the ceiling. Its face was completely hidden beneath its hood. Harry's eyes darted downward, and what he saw made his stomach contract. There was a hand protruding from the cloak, and it was glistening, grayish, slimy-looking, and scabbed like something dead that had decayed in water. But it was visible only for a split second. As though the creature beneath the cloak sensed Harry's gaze, the hand was suddenly withdrawn into the folds of its black cloak. And then the thing beneath the hood, whatever it was, drew a long, slow, rattling breath, as though it were trying to suck something more than air from its surroundings. An intense cold swept over them all. Harry felt his own breath catch in his chest. The cold went deeper than his skin. It was inside his chest. It was inside his very heart. Harry's eyes rolled up into his head. He couldn't see. He was drowning in cold. There was a rushing in his ears as though of water. He was being dragged downward, the roaring growing louder. And then, from far away, he heard screaming, terrible, terrified, pleading screams. He wanted to help whoever it was. He tried to move his arms, but couldn't. A thick white fog was swirling around him, inside him. "Harry, Harry, are you all right?" Someone slapped his face. "What? What?" Harry opened his eyes. There were lanterns above him, and the floor was shaking. The Hogwarts Express was moving again, and the lights had come back on. He seemed to have slid out of his seat onto the floor. Ron and Hermione were kneeling next to him, and above them he could see Neville and Professor Lupin watching. Harry felt very sick. When he put up his hand to push his glasses back on, he felt cold sweat on his face. Ron and Hermione heaved him back onto his seat. "Are you okay?" Ron asked nervously. "Yeah," said Harry, looking quickly toward the door. The hooded creature had vanished. "What happened? Where's that thing? Who screamed?" "No one screamed," said Ron, more nervously still. Harry looked around the bright compartment. Ginny and Neville looked back at him, both very pale. "But I heard something." A loud snap made them all jump. Professor Lupin was breaking an enormous slab of chocolate into pieces. "Here," he said to Harry, handing him a particularly large piece. "Eat it. It will help." Harry took the chocolate, but didn't eat it. "What was that thing?" he asked Lupin. "A Dementor," said Lupin, who was now giving chocolate to everyone else. "One of the Dementors of Azkaban. A guard searching for Sirius Black." They didn't talk much during the remainder of the journey. At long last, the train stopped at Hogmead Station, and there was a great scramble to get outside. Owls hooted, cats meowed, and Neville's pet toad croaked loudly from under his hat. It was freezing on the tiny platform. Rain was driving down in icy sheets. Harry, Ron, and Hermione joined the Gryffindors, streaming up the marble staircase, and very tired now, moved along more corridors, up more and more stairs, to the hidden entrance to Gryffindor Tower. A large portrait of a fat lady in a pink dress asked them, "Password?" "Coming through, coming through," Percy called from behind the crowd. "The new password's Fortuna Major." "Oh, no," said Neville Longbottom sadly. He always had trouble remembering the passwords. Through the portrait hole and across the common room, the girls and boys divided toward their separate staircases. Harry climbed the spiral stair with no thought of his head except how glad he was to be back. They reached their familiar circular dormitory with its 5 four-poster beds, and Harry, looking around, felt he was home at last. Chapter 6. Talons and Tea Leaves. When Harry, Ron, and Hermione entered the Great Hall for breakfast the next day, the first thing they saw was Draco Malfoy, who seemed to be entertaining a large group of Slytherins with a very funny story. As they passed, Malfoy did a ridiculous impression of a swooning fit, and there was a roar of laughter. "Ignore him," said Hermione, who was right behind Harry. "Just ignore him. It's not worth it." "Harry Potter!" shrieked Pansy Parkinson, a Slytherin girl with a face like a pug. "Potter! The Dementors are coming! Potter! Woo!" Harry dropped into a seat at the Gryffindor table, next to George Weasley. Harry and his friends begin their classes. In divination, Professor Trelawney predicts dark things for Harry. In Care of Magical Creatures, Hagrid proudly introduces a hippogriff named Buckbeak, who bows politely to Harry and lets him ride. "Good work, Harry," roared Hagrid, as everyone except Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle cheered. "Okay, who else wants to go?" Emboldened by Harry's success, the rest of the class climbed cautiously into the paddock. Hagrid untied the hippogriffs one by one, and soon people were bowing nervously all over the paddock. Neville ran repeatedly backward from his, which didn't seem to want to bend its knees. Ron and Hermione practiced on the chestnut while Harry watched. Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle had taken over Buckbeak. He had bowed to Malfoy, who was now patting his beak, looking disdainful. "This is very easy," Malfoy drawled, loud enough for Harry to hear him. "I knew it must have been if Potter could do it." "I bet you're not dangerous at all, are you?" he said to the hippogriff. "Are you, you great ugly brute?" It happened in a flash of steely talons. Malfoy let out a high-pitched scream, "Ah!" And the next moment, Hagrid was wrestling Buckbeak back into his collar as he strained to get Malfoy, who lay curled in the grass, blood blossoming over his robes. "I'm dying!" Malfoy yelled as the class panicked. "I'm dying! Look at me! It killed me!" "You're not dying," said Hagrid, who had gone very white. "Someone help me. Gotta get him out of here." Hermione ran to hold open the gate as Hagrid lifted Malfoy easily. As they passed, Harry saw that there was a long, deep gash on Malfoy's arm. Blood splattered the grass, and Hagrid ran with him, up the slope toward the castle. Very shaken, the Care of Magical Creatures class followed at a walk. The Slytherins were all shouting about Hagrid.
"They should fire him straight away,"
said Pansy Parkinson, who was in tears. "It was Malfoy's fault," snapped Dean Thomas. Crabbe and Goyle flexed their muscles threateningly. "Oh, that was a really bad thing to happen in Hagrid's first class, though, wasn't it?" said Ron, looking worried. "Trust Malfoy to mess things up for him." They were among the first to reach the Great Hall at dinner time, hoping to see Hagrid. But he wasn't there.
"They wouldn't fire him, would they?"
said Hermione anxiously, not touching her steak and kidney pudding.
"They'd better not," said Ron, who wasn't eating either.
They went up to the crowded Gryffindor common room after dinner and tried to do homework Professor McGonagall had given them. But all three of them kept breaking off and glancing out of the tower window.
"There's a light on in Hagrid's window," Harry said suddenly. Ron looked at his watch. "If we hurried, we could go down and see him. It's still quite early."
"I don't know," Hermione said slowly, and Harry saw her glance at him. "I am allowed to walk across the grounds," he said pointedly. "Sirius Black hasn't got past the Dementors yet, has he?" So they put their things away and headed out of the portrait hole, glad to meet nobody on their way to the front doors, as they weren't entirely sure they were supposed to be out. The grass was still wet and looked almost black in the twilight. When they reached Hagrid's hut, they knocked, and a voice growled,
"Come in."
Hagrid was sitting in his shirt sleeves at his scrubbed wooden table. His boarhound, Fang, had his head in Hagrid's lap. One look told them that Hagrid had been drinking a lot. There was a pewter tankard almost as big as a bucket in front of him. He seemed to be having difficulty getting them into focus.
"'Spect it's a record," he said thickly when he recognized them. "Don't reckon there ever had a teacher who lasted only a day before."
"You haven't been fired, Hagrid," gasped Hermione.
"Not yet," said Hagrid miserably, taking a huge gulp of whatever was in the tankard. "But it's only a matter of time, isn't it? After Malfoy."
Tears leaked out of the crinkled corners of Hagrid's beetle-black eyes. He grabbed both Harry and Ron and pulled them into a bone-breaking hug. "I think you've had enough to drink, Hagrid," said Hermione firmly. She took the tankard from the table and went outside to empty it.
Maybe she's right, said Hagrid, letting go of Harry and Ron, who both staggered away, rubbing their ribs.
Hagrid heaved himself out of his chair and followed Hermione unsteadily outside. They heard a loud splash.
What's he done? Said Harry nervously as Hermione came back with the empty tankard.
Stuck his head in the water barrel, said Hermione, putting the tankard away.
Hagrid came back, his long hair and beard sopping wet, wiping the water out of his eyes.
That's better, he said, shaking his head like a dog and drenching them all. Listen, it was good of you to come out and see me, really.
Hagrid stopped dead, staring at Harry as though he'd only just realized he was there.
What do you think you're doing, eh?
He roared so suddenly that they jumped a foot in the air.
You're not to go wandering around after dark, Harry. And you too, letting them.
Hagrid strode over to Harry, grabbed his arm, and pulled him to the door.
Come on, Hagrid said angrily. I'm taking you all back to school, and don't let me catch you walking down to see me after dark again. I'm not worth that.
Chapter 7. The Bogart and the Wardrobe. Malfoy didn't reappear in classes until late on Thursday morning, when the Slytherins and the Gryffindors were halfway through double potions. He swaggered into the dungeon, his right arm covered in bandages and bound up in a sling, acting, in Harry's opinion, as though he were the heroic survivor of some dreadful battle.
"How is it, Draco?" simpered Pansy Parkinson. "Does it hurt much?"
"Yeah," says Malfoy, putting on a brave sort of grimace. But Harry saw him wink at Crabbe and Goyle when Pansy had looked away.
Professor Lupin teaches the class how to face a Bogart, a creature that becomes your worst fear.
"Now then," said Professor Lupin, beckoning the class toward the end of the room where there was nothing but an old wardrobe where teachers kept their spare robes. As Professor Lupin went to stand next to it, the wardrobe gave a sudden wobble, banging off the wall.
"Nothing to worry about," said Professor Lupin calmly, because a few people had jumped backward in alarm. "There's a Bogart in there." Most people seemed to feel that this was something to worry about. Neville gave Professor Lupin a look of pure terror. And Seamus Finnegan eyed the now rattling doorknob apprehensively.
"Bogarts like dark, enclosed spaces," said Professor Lupin. "Wardrobes, the gap beneath beds, the cupboards under sinks. I've even met one that had lodged itself in a grandfather clock. This one moved in yesterday afternoon, and I asked the headmaster if the staff would leave it to give my third years some practice. So the first question we must ask ourselves is, what is a Bogart?"
Hermione put up her hand.
"It's a shapeshifter," she said. "It can take the shape of whatever it thinks will frighten us most."
"Couldn't have put it better myself," said Professor Lupin, and Hermione glowed.
"So the Bogart, sitting in the darkness within, has not yet assumed a form. He does not yet know what will frighten the person on the other side of the door. Nobody knows what a Bogart looks like when he is alone, but when I let him out, he will immediately become whatever each of us most fears. This means," Professor Lupin, choosing to ignore Neville's small sputter of terror, "that we have a huge advantage over the Bogart before we begin. Have you spotted it, Harry?" Trying to answer a question with Hermione next to him, bobbing up and down on the balls of her feet with her hand in the air, was very off-putting, but Harry had a go.
Because there are so many of us, it wouldn't know what shape it should be."
"Precisely," said Professor Lupin, and Hermione put her hand down, looking a little disappointed. "It's always best to have company when you're dealing with a Bogart. He becomes confused. Which should he become? A headless corpse or a flesh-eating slug? I once saw a Bogart make that very mistake, tried to frighten two people at once and turned himself into a half a slug. Not remotely frightening. The charm that repels a Bogart is simple, yet it requires force of mind. You see, the thing that really finishes a Bogart is laughter. What you need to do is force it to assume a shape that you find amusing. We will practice the charm without wands first. After me, please. Ridiculous! Ridiculous!" said the class together.
"Good," said Professor Lupin. "Very good. But that was the easy part, I'm afraid. You see, the word alone is not enough. With
laughter and courage, the students turn their fears silly. Lupin protects Harry gently, not wanting him to face something too frightening.
"That was the best defense against the dark arts lesson we've ever had, wasn't it?" said Ron excitedly as they made their way back to the classroom to get their bags.
"He seems like a very good teacher," said Hermione approvingly. "But I wish I could have had a turn with the Bogart."
"What would it have been for you?" said Ron, sniggering.
"A piece of homework that only got 9 out of 10?
Chapter 8. Flight of the Fat Lady.
In no time at all, defense against the dark arts had become most people's favorite class. Only Draco Malfoy and his gang of Slytherins had anything bad to say about Professor Lupin.
"Look at the state of his robes," Malfoy would say in a loud whisper as Professor Lupin passed. "He dresses like our old house elf."
But no one else cared that Professor Lupin's robes were patched and frayed. His next few lessons were just as interesting as the first. After Bogart's, they studied red caps, nasty little goblin-like creatures that lurked whenever there had been bloodshed, in the dungeons of castles and the potholes of deserted battlefields, waiting to bludgeon those who had gotten lost. From red caps, they moved on to kappas, creepy water dwellers that looked like scaly monkeys with webbed hands itching to strangle unwitting waders in their ponds. One night, the Gryffindor students returned to find their common room entrance slashed. The fat lady's portrait is torn, and she's missing. Everyone is frightened. Someone dangerous may be inside the castle. The fat lady vanished from her portrait, which had been slashed so viciously that strips of canvas littered the floor. Great chunks of it had been torn away completely. Dumbledore took one quick look at the ruined painting and turned his eyes somber to see Professors McGonagall, Lupin, and Snape hurrying toward him.
"We need to find her," said Dumbledore.
"Professor McGonagall, please go to Mr. Filch at once and tell him to search every painting in the castle for the fat lady."
You'll be lucky," said a crackling voice. It was Peeves, the poltergeist, bobbing over the crowd and looking delighted, as he always did, at the sight of a wreckage or worry.
"What do you mean, Peeves?" said Dumbledore calmly, and Peeves' grin faded a little. He didn't dare to taunt Dumbledore. Instead, he adopted an oily voice that was no better than his cackle.
"Ashamed your headship, sir, doesn't want to be seen. She's a horrible mess. Saw her running through the landscape up on the fourth floor, sir, dodging between the trees, crying something dreadful," he said happily. "Poor thing," he added unconvincingly.
"Did she say who did it?" said Dumbledore quietly.
"Oh, yes, Professor Head," said Peeves, with the air of one cradling a large bombshell in his arms. "He got very angry when she wouldn't let him in, you see."
Peeves flipped over and grinned at Dumbledore from between his own legs.
"Nasty temper he's got, that Sirius Black."
Chapter 9. Grim Defeat. Professor Dumbledore sent all the Gryffindors back to the Great Hall, where they were joined 10 minutes later by the students from Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Slytherin, who all looked extremely confused.
"The teachers and I need to conduct a thorough search of the castle," Professor Dumbledore told them, as Professors McGonagall and Flitwick closed all the doors into the hall. "I'm afraid that for your own safety, you will have to spend the night here. I want the prefects to stand guard over the entrances to the hall, and I am leaving the head boy and girl in charge. Any disturbance should be reported to me immediately," he added to Percy, who was looking immensely proud and important. "Send word with one of the ghosts." During a stormy Quidditch match, Harry sees the black dog again. Then Dementors swarm the field, and Harry falls from his broom. He turned, intending to head back toward the middle of the field, but at that moment another flash of lightning illuminated the stands, and Harry saw something that distracted him completely. The silhouette of an enormous, shaggy, black dog clearly imprinted against the sky, motionless in the topmost empty row of seats. Harry's numb hand slipped on the broom handle, and his nimbus dropped a few feet. Shaking his sodden bangs out of his eyes, he squinted back into the stands. The dog had vanished. "Harry!" came Wood's anguished yell from the Gryffindor goalposts. "Harry, behind you!" Harry looked wildly around. Cedric Diggory was pelting up the field, and a tiny speck of gold was shimmering in the rain-filled air between them. With a jolt of panic, Harry threw himself flat to the broom's handle and zoomed toward the Snitch. "Come on," he growled at his nimbus as the rain whipped his face. "Faster!" But something odd was happening. An eerie silence was falling across the stadium. The wind, though as strong as ever, was forgetting to roar. It was as though someone had turned off the sound, as though Harry had gone suddenly deaf. What was going on? And then a horribly familiar wave of cold swept over him, inside him, just as he became aware of something moving on the field below. Before he'd had time to think, Harry had taken his eyes off the Snitch and looked down. At least 100 Dementors, their hidden faces pointing up at him, were standing beneath him. It was as though freezing water were rising in his chest, cutting at his insides. And then he heard it again. Someone was screaming inside his head. A woman!
"Not Harry! Not Harry! Please, not Harry! Stand aside, you silly girl! Stand aside now! Not Harry! Please, no! Take me! Kill me instead!"
Numbing, swirling white mist was filling Harry's brain. What was he doing? Why was he flying? He needed to help her. She was going to die. She was going to be murdered. He was falling through the icy mist.
"Not Harry, please have mercy, have mercy."
A shrill voice was laughing. The woman was screaming, and Harry knew no more. Lucky the ground was so soft. I thought he was dead for sure. But he didn't even break his glasses. Harry could hear the voices whispering, but they made no sense whatsoever. He didn't have a clue where he was or how he got there or what he'd been doing before he got there. All he knew was that every inch of him was aching as though it had been beaten.
"That was the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life."
Scariest. The scariest thing. Hooded black figures. Cold. Screaming. Harry's eyes snapped open. He was lying in the hospital wing. The Gryffindor Quidditch team, spattered with mud from head to foot, was gathered round his bed. Ron and Hermione were also there, looking as though they'd just climbed out of a swimming pool. Harry lay there, not saying a word. They had lost. For the first time ever, he had lost a Quidditch match. After 10 minutes or so, Madame Pomfrey came over to tell the team to leave him in peace.
"We'll come to see you later," Fred told him. "Don't beat yourself up, Harry. You're still the best seeker we've ever had."
The team trooped out, trailing mud behind them. Madame Pomfrey shut the door behind them, looking disapproving. Ron and Hermione moved nearer to Harry's bed.
Dumbledore was really angry, Hermione said in a quanky voice. I've never seen him like that before. He ran onto the field as you fell, waved his wand, and you sort of slowed down before you hit the ground. Then he whirled his wand at the Dementors, shot silver stuff at them. They left the stadium right away. He was furious they'd come onto the grounds. We heard him. Then he magicked you onto a stretcher, said Ron, and walked up to the school with you floating on it. Did somebody get my Nimbus? Ron and Hermione looked quickly at each other. What? Said Harry, looking from one to the other. Well, when you fell off, it got blown away, said Hermione hesitantly. And it hit, oh, Harry, it hit the Whomping Willow. Harry's insides lurched. The Whomping Willow was a very violent tree that stood alone in the middle of the grounds. And, he said, dreading the answer, well, you know the Whomping Willow, said Ron. It doesn't like being hit. Professor Flitbeck brought it back just before you came around, said Hermione in a very small voice. Slowly, she reached down for a bag at her feet, turned it upside down, and tipped a dozen bits of splintered wood and twig onto the bed, the only remains of Harry's faithful, finally beaten broomstick. He is safe, but his beloved broom is destroyed. Harry feels shaken and confused.